Good. Okay, so Dharmadipa said, thank you, Dharmadipa. I'm going to talk about wisdom and ignorance. And in a way, it's quite a difficult subject to talk about because it's difficult to grasp because it means actually getting hold of your own mind. And it's like, I don't know, like trying to sort of see the back of your head or something like that. So ignorance or avidya is the most fundamental of the kleshas. And it goes very, very deep. In fact, it's said that, well, it's part of the structure of our consciousness. It's part of the way that we see things. And it's said that it doesn't just go back this life. It doesn't just go back one or two lifetimes. It goes back to beginningless time. You never find a beginning to ignorance. So it's very, very deep. And, you know, with the other kleshas that we've been looking at, they can be worked on and changed to some extent, at least temporarily, through ethics and through meditation in the sense of dhyana. But for ignorance, to really penetrate ignorance, you need to develop pranya, you need to develop wisdom, or non-deludedness, amoha. So you could say that not only does it go very deep, but it's habitual. And ignorance isn't something that it isn't something that just happens to us. It's like we choose not to see the truth. So we choose to see permanence where there's just impermanence. We choose to see things as substantial where they're insubstantial. And we choose to see things as giving us lasting satisfaction, which, by their very impermanence, aren't able to do that. And perhaps deepest of all, we have this sense of a fixed, unchanging, separate self. You know, and maybe we think we can change a little bit, but usually we put some limits on the amount we can change. And it's as if we feel there's this essence there standing behind our experience and governing our experience, which can't be changed, and we identify with it all the way through our lives. So even as we get older, you know, even as our bodies age and change, there's this this continuous identifying with this what we call a self or a soul or something like that, or an essence. And the thing about it is that if you really look for it, you can't find it because it doesn't exist. But that doesn't stop us. That doesn't stop us actually trying to center the world around it. Okay, so ignorance expresses itself through views. Our attitudes and our stances on life usually express themselves through the views that we hold. And part of the reason we do study groups and we have retreats like this is so that those views can come to the surface and be challenged. So Dharma study, and particularly Dharma study in groups and discussion, is one of the best ways to work on ignorance and to work on our views, which are the manifestations of ignorance. And there are basically two types of views. So there are what we call inborn views. They're the views that we're actually born with, they're innate. And there are acquired views, which are the views that we pick up through life, you know, through current mitya ditties, through our conditioning, popular views, through the press, the media, through our culture, our particular temperament, so on. So first of all, I just want to talk about these inborn views or inborn kleshas. They're called Atma Klesha, I think, which means inborn or innate kleshas. So they're the kleshas, the afflictions that we're actually born with. And the good news about them is that they don't make us a bad person. I'll say more about that later. They're sort of ethically neutral. They're just we're just born with them. They just happen to us, It's part of having the type of consciousness that we have. So, you know, what are these four inborn kleshas? And they're quite an important list. They're maybe not one that's spoken about very much, but you find them in the Yogacara. And the first one is just ignorance. And this tends to centre upon having a self-view. So we just have this sense of self, this sense of a separate self that's behind our experience. And then, the second one is self-view. So we start to, we don't just have a sense of a separate self, we start to build up views about it. So such things as we start to see the world as divided into self and other, as me and the world. We believe that behind our experience there's something fixed and unchanging, an essence or a soul. The thing that thinks our thoughts, feels our feelings, and directs our actions. And all of this gives us this illusion that we're actually in control of our lives. But we're not, you know. And as soon as you start to examine this more closely, maybe you examine it in Vipassana meditation, you start to see that this isn't the case, that we're not in control. We're not in control of our bodies. We're not in control of our thoughts. Otherwise, we could just choose what we think, or we could choose what happens with our bodies. We don't control our life. Our life is going on independent of our control. So maybe this sense of a separate fixed self is quite hazy and quite confused, but we all have it, and we all want to protect it. So that's the second atmaklesha, which is self-view. Thirdly, not only do we have this sense of a self, but we want it to be the best self. We want it to be special. We want it to be the most significant self. And we start to compare ourselves with others. And according to Buddhism, we can compare ourselves both in terms of seeing ourselves superior to others, or equal to others, or inferior to others. But even if we see ourselves as inferior to others, it's a sort of special inferiority. You know, we're specially inferior. And if we say we're equal to others, perhaps what we're really saying is that nobody's better than we are. So this is conceit. And lastly, there's attachment to self. And this is sometimes called self-cherishing. And we're particularly attached to ourself. In a way, we are the most important thing in the universe, which is sort of difficult because everybody else thinks the same too. And in itself, it's fine. You know, it's quite good to have a healthy pride. It's quite good to able to admit to yourself that you're the most important thing in your life. You're the most important thing in the universe. Perhaps you think the universe circles around you. I think we all do to some extent. It's only when that self starts to clash with other selves and we respond with greed or hatred that it becomes an ethical issue. But just to have this self-cherishing, to think we're the centre of the universe, doesn't mean we're a bad person. It's not an ethical issue. So these are important, these inborn kleshas of ignorance, views, conceit, and attachment. And the Buddha saw this very clearly. The Buddha said that he surveyed the universe, and wherever he looked in the universe, he couldn't find anything that was more dear to one than one's own self. So this can also be used positively, and it can be used as the basis for the Metta Bhavana practice. And I think this is a very good way of doing the Metta Bhavana, a very effective way of doing the Metta Bhavana. And I think it brings in an element of insight. You're actually reflecting on things the way that they really are in terms of self-cherishing. So how do we do this? In the first stage, we just try to contact that sense of our own importance to ourselves. Even if we don't like ourselves or think we don't like ourselves, we're still very important to ourselves. So we contact that. We contact that self-cherishing. We get up in the morning. We wash ourselves. We dress. We eat our breakfast. We come on a retreat like this. And we come on a retreat like this because we care about ourselves, because we think it's going to make us happy. And it's probably one of the wiser choices you can make in terms of self-cherishing. There are a lot of other things, or just about everything that we do, is motivated by self-cherishing. It's motivated by the fact that we want to be happy, we want to grow, we want to be fulfilled, but because we're ignorant, we make unwise choices. And that's the real tragedy, really. But in the Metta Bhavana, we start off by contacting that self-cherishing. And it's all right to think of ourselves as being of the centre of the universe. But then in the other stages, what we have to realise is that it's just the same for everybody else. So everybody in this room, each of us, believes that we're the centre of the universe. Our own selves is the most important thing to us. And so we start to see that other people are just like us in that respect. Their own happiness is important, their own growth is important, just in the same way it's important to us. So you could say this is equalising self and other. We're all equal in that respect. So I love myself, you love yourself, we can get along on that basis. just in the same way that you wish yourself to be happy and to find more skillful, more intelligent ways to actually bring about your happiness, you can do the same for during each stage of the Metta Bhavana. So that way you can use this self-cherishing to empathise with other people and feel solidarity with other people. And the other point is that until we have insight, we're always going to have these atmaklesas. They're always going to be present. It doesn't mean that we necessarily behave unethically. We can also cultivate skillful mental states, mundane skillful mental states, while having these atmaklesas in place. Because it's only when we come to develop wisdom that we actually start to break them and start to see through them. So we can develop quite a long way while the atmaklesha is still in place, but sooner or later we're going to have to break them decisively if we're not going to limit our development, and we're going to have to actually see through them and renounce them. Okay, I just want to say a little bit about this language of no self, because I think we have to be quite careful with this language of no self, and quite careful not to use it too soon, not to use it prematurely, because we live in quite a nihilistic society, and sometimes it can be caught up with our own nihilism. And I remember hearing a story about Banti, and which he told about the early days of the movement. And he said that he was on retreat, and there was a woman on retreat with him, and she kept going on about no self, that she really liked the teaching of Atman, Anatma, the teaching of no self. And then one day she came to Bhante and she said, I just realised why I like this teaching so much. She said, I don't like myself. I hate myself, so I want to get rid of myself. So I think what we have to be careful of when we start talking about Anatman or the Anatman doctrine is that we don't bypass the bits that we don't like about ourselves. This is called spiritual bypassing. You know, that we don't ignore the areas that we really need to work on, which are probably at quite a basic level of development, in order to move on to these higher metaphysical teachings, and in that way deny the work that we actually need to do. And I'm very struck by a phrase of Bhante's, and he says that the highest teaching is the teaching that you need, it's what you need to work on right now. That's the highest teaching for you. And I know that Bhante much prefers the language of growth. He says that it's much better if we think in terms of growth, becoming more than we are now, and we reach a certain level where we focus on the language of growth, and the whole thing about Anatman will sort itself out in time when we're ready to actually work with it. And he says that what the language of Anatman is actually getting at is that we don't identify with a particular stage of our development and say, this is it, this is me, that's the end of it. So we don't fix a particular stage of our development and say, this is me, that's as far as I can go. He says it's a bit like the idea of a fixed self is a bit like arrested development, that we identify with a particular level of development and say, that's it, that's me. Whereas obviously there are whole dimensions that we can grow into. Okay, so there are a number of acquired views, and these are prejudices, assumptions and attitudes that we hold. And they're usually unconscious, and quite often they're contradictory. It's not like we have one uniform view. We hold a whole number of contradictory views, usually hardly conscious. We're hardly aware of them. And they take different forms depending on our conditioning, our temperament, our culture. But I just want to particularly deal with one list, because they're very important again. And it's another set of four. And they're the four basic views that make spiritual development impossible. So they're very important. And I'll deal with them a bit more briefly. So the first view is that we deny ethical responsibility for our actions. We don't actually take responsibility for our actions. Maybe we blame other people, or we blame situations, or whatever. And this makes living the Dharma life impossible. Buddhist morality, kusala, isn't just morality in the narrow sense. Kusala is all those actions that lead to enlightenment, and that's skillful. Skillful actions are actions that lead to enlightenment, and unskillful actions are actions that lead away from enlightenment. So if we're not able to, first of all, just take responsibility for our actions, there's no possibility of growth. So that's the first one. The second one is to deny the operation of karma, or as Subhuti would say, karma nirma processes. So we live in an ethical universe, which is quite amazing. We live in a universe where skillful actions lead to happiness and to an unfoldment and growth in consciousness and being, whereas unskillful actions lead to suffering. So do we have faith in karma? Very, very important. Do we have faith that skillful actions lead to happiness and unfoldment? Because if we don't, again, it makes the path impossible. So the third view that makes spiritual development impossible is to deny Dharma Nyama processes. So this, if you like, is the spiral path. As we progress along the spiral path, as our actions become more and more skillful, we reach a certain point where skillful actions predominate over unskillful actions. And Dharma Nyama processes start to erupt. We start to actually see into the nature of reality. And this starts to happen more and more. And this is entering the transcendental path, starting at stream entry, or starting with the arising of the bodhicitta that leads up to enlightenment. And again, this is a natural law. We live in a universe, as Bhante says, where stones fall to the ground and enlightenment is an ever-present possibility. And fourthly and lastly, if we deny the possibility of someone realising the ultimate truth, then we make the upper reaches of spiritual life impossible. So these Dharma Nyama processes carry us beyond ourselves. And something new starts to work through us. We reach a point where we're no longer practicing through the egoistic will. And it's as if some sort of force, you could call it the bodhicitta, you could call it a suprapersonal force, starts to work through us and carries us towards enlightenment. And this is after the arising of transcendental wisdom. So it's important we examine ourselves regarding these wrong views. And the real test is behaviour. Do we behave as if our actions have consequences? Do we believe? Do we behave as if we believe in the law of karma and so on? Because our behaviour is the test of what we really believe. And I remember Bhante some time ago saying that he thought it would be very interesting to know what order members really thought. So I want you to look at these in the discussion groups tomorrow. I want you to look at these four areas. Do you believe that your actions have consequences? And does that bear itself out in your behaviour? And where does it not? And the same, do you have faith in karma? Do you have faith in the possibility of a transcendental path? And do you have faith in the possibility of the bodhicitta arising in you? Okay, there's a few more areas which I just want to touch on to do with views. And I just want to say one or two things about each. And you can open them up and explore them in the discussion groups tomorrow. So the first one is, I just want to touch on eternalism and nihilism. So broadly speaking, all our views fall into eternalism and nihilism. Do we believe in a heaven, at the end of life, or do we believe that when we die the lights go out and that's it? And they're the two broad categories of views. And we tend to be either nihilistic or eternalistic in our outlook, probably optimistic or pessimistic. And there's a lot of nihilism around, I think, in our particular society. So we probably need to work more on that end. And to that end, I just want to say something about probably the most basic insight, which is insight into impermanence. So I think it's very important when we look at impermanence not to see impermanence just in terms of things ending. Impermanence is also arising. So if we tend to look on the dark side of life, it's probably good to look at the arisings, to focus more on arisings. New things coming into being, the possibility of change, the possibility of growth, spring rather than autumn and winter, things bursting into flower, you know, new qualities arising and so on. And look at impermanence in that sort of way, and the other Buddhist truths in that sort of way. If we're very, very buoyant and very eternalistic and we're very lazy because of that, we don't make any effort, then maybe we need to focus more on death, you know, and things finishing and so on. So, you know, I think it's very important to use these truths intelligently and to view them in the light of your own particular temperament. Okay, just a word about dogmatism. One aspect of right view is that right view is always held lightly. So if someone insists on right view, they're wrong. even though what they're saying might be right, they're wrong. So light views are always held lightly. And the reason they're held lightly is because they're always provisional. So it's important that whatever our understanding of the Dharma now, we see it as provisional. It's just temporary. We have this understanding. Sooner or later, we'll have a deeper understanding, and we never get fixed on our present understanding. We always see it as provisional. We always see it as limited, all the way up to enlightenment. And another interesting point about this is there's no blasphemy in Buddhism. So there's no question of feeling offended if other people don't hold your views, or even if they ridicule your views. And we had a really interesting thing happen in Norwich with this a few years ago. And there was a lot of this stuff about inciting racial hatred going around at the time. And Padma Dharka was the chairman in the centre in Norwich at the time. And there was an art gallery. And in the art gallery, one of the pieces of art was a Buddha in the window of this art gallery with a huge phallus, which was a banana and two oranges. And this was a piece of art. And I think various people were coming in and complaining about it, saying, do you want to do something about it? And in the end, the police phoned up and said, do you want to prosecute the art gallery? And Padma Dharka just said, no, we're just not like that. You know, people can do what they like. There's no blasphemy in Buddhism. Okay, the next one, I'll go into this a little bit more, is vichikitsa, sorry, vagueness, or equivocal doubt. So this is a particular type of doubt. And it's sitting on the fence. It's never making up your mind, never actually committing yourself to the spiritual life, keeping your options open. And the Pali for it is vichikitsa. I'm not quite sure how you spell that. But what it means is two-pointedness of mind, which I think is quite interesting. So you've always got two options, and you're always swinging backwards and forwards between the two. But the main point is that you never commit yourself, so you're never able to be wholehearted about your practice. And I come across this sometimes, you know, and I even come across it with men who've asked for ordination, and sometimes people say, well, I asked for ordination, but I'm not sure I want to get ordained. I suppose I take it that if you've asked for ordination, you've asked because you've made up your mind, you want to get ordained. And life is short, You know, and we only have a limited time. There's an urgency, and the spiritual path is vast, and there's so much work to do. So don't sit on the fence for too long. Make up your mind. And, you know, what are the options anyway? You know, it's not like we'd be living these amazing, exciting lives if we didn't commit ourselves to the Dharma. In a sense, I think, I always thought of the Dharma as the last great adventure. You know, so, you know, most people have done most things. It's quite easy to go up Everest now. People have been to the moon. But the last great adventure is the spiritual life, because you're exploring unknown terrain, you know, which is your own mind and your relationships with other people. So make up your mind. And in the old days, we didn't used to talk about going for refuge. Bhante used to talk about commitment. You know, is he committed? Have you committed yourself? So maybe think in terms of commitment. And these doubts tend to express themselves in six different ways. And I'm not going to go into six very fully. So there are six different areas that we tend to doubt. And you can draw these out in the study group. And the first three are the three jewels: the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And the other three are the mundane equivalent to the three jewels. So it's where we experience the three jewels right now in our lives. So these three are the teacher, his teaching, and the community. The teacher, his teaching, and the community. And it's very, very easy. You know, there's so much Buddhism around. There are so many different possibilities. And there are all these possibilities on the internet. And it's very, very easy to keep your options open, you know, and to go from teacher to teacher, try different things, you know, maybe try another teacher, another form of meditation or whatever. But the danger, the real danger, is that you remain superficial. And there's a story, which I think it may be a Zen story. And the story is that there are two friends. And one friend goes to a monastery. And for 20 years, he studies with the same teacher. And the other friend goes off wandering. And he goes around, and he goes to different teachers. And he goes to 20 different teachers. So he goes to a different teacher each year. At the end of this 20-year period, he comes back to the monastery. And he says to his friend at the monastery, how many teachers have you studied with? And his friend says, well, I've just been here all the time for 20 years. I've just studied with one teacher. And he says, well, I've studied with 20 different teachers. So the guy who stayed at the monastery says, yes, you've studied 20 teachings for 1 year. I've studied one teaching for 20 years. and of course, you know, you actually need to narrow down in order to go deeper. This is one of the basic principles of the spiritual path. You need to narrow down in order to go deeper. And it's much, much better. You make much more progress if you can make up your mind and just focus on a few teachings and take them deeper. And in a way, they're not the same practices, you know, because if we practice the same practices and we practice them for 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, they start to open out. And, I mean, I'm not doing the same mindfulness breathing that I was doing 30 or 40 years ago. It's a very, very different practice. And paradoxically, if you go really deeply into one teacher, with one teacher, and with one particular group of disciples, you can understand all teachings, because in the end, they all come to the same place. They all lead to the same goal. So it gives you a way of understanding all the teachings. And I remember my very first encounter with Buddhism was with a Burmese teacher in India called Goenka. This was 1977 in India. And I was very struck by something that he said at the end of the course. He said, you don't have to come back and do retreats with me, but when you go away from here, it's important that you find a teacher and you settle for that. And he said, if you want to fly from Bombay to New York, you can fly east or you can fly west. But if you fly a little bit east and a little bit west, you're never going to arrive. So make up your mind about the three jewels. Make up your mind about your teacher and the teaching you're going to follow and the community that you're going to follow it with. And if we do experience doubt, and we will experience doubt, it's our responsibility to resolve our doubts. As practitioners, that's our responsibility, not to let doubts carry on because they'll impede our progress. We won't be able to be wholehearted. So we're responsible for clarifying our doubts. Now, I just want to touch upon another sort of doubt, which is very different, and that's big doubt. And big doubt is part of the path, because if we're going deeper into the teachings, doubts are going to arise. But they're doubts about reality. And what you find, if you start to do Vipassana meditation, if you start to reflect more deeply on the Dharma, you find it throws up more questions than it does answers. And then you have to go back and clarify your understanding, and that takes you deeper. So big doubt is a good thing. There's something in the Kadampa precepts where it might be a teacher or one of his other teachers, and he says something like, merely to ask, is the self empty or not, tears samsara asunder. So that's big doubt. And in a way, doubt is part of faith. If we have faith, we're not afraid to test the teachings and to test them more deeply. Okay, I'll be quite brief. There's just a little bit more I want to go into. And this is clarity, a moha, or non-ignorance. And on my own ordination retreat in 1984, I remember Bhante saying that Buddhists should be characterised by clear thinking and positive emotion. And there's always been this emphasis in Bhante's teachings on clear thinking. And clear thinking culminates in prajna, in wisdom. And it's quite interesting, the idea of wisdom, because it's not about book learning. And it's not, Dharma study is important, but it's not necessarily about doing more study. And I noticed this some years ago. I took up the Manjugosha practice, which is concerned with developing prajna. And what I noticed was that it wasn't that I became more intelligent or more intellectual. It was just that my emotional turmoil, my emotional unclarity, started to untangle and started to clear up. So, and then I saw things more clearly. So I think a lot of our unclarity is our emotional unclarity. And we need to clarify our emotions as well. And then the mind will tend to become clearer. Okay, wisdom depends upon our whole spiritual life, our whole context, and its basis is ethics and meditation, and it's progressive. The Buddha compares it to the great ocean. He says it shelves down gradually, so there's no abrupt penetration of wisdom. So it builds up as we practice. And we must have a certain amount of wisdom already, a certain amount of insight, in order to want to commit ourselves to the Dharma. So don't underestimate the wisdom that you already have. And so it is progressive, and there are three levels of wisdom. These are the three levels of wisdom. They're quite sort of basic. And the first level is hearing. Or reading, you could say, in our case. Traditionally, you'd be sitting at the feet of a teacher. And it's just basically making sure you understand and you're clear about what's actually being said or what's being written. So that's the basis. The second level is reflecting. And this is really making the Dharma your own. It's much more applying the Dharma to your experience. And applying the Dharma to the deepest questions of your life, to the existential questions of your life. And if you do this enough, you reach a stage where conviction arises. And this is very important. So wisdom is not a question of being intellectually clear. We always understand much more than we can actually find emotional equivalence for. It's actually a question of being emotionally convinced of the truth of the Dharma. The intellect by itself is too superficial. We need to be actually emotionally convinced that what the Dharma is saying is true. And this is reflecting. And then the third level is the level of meditation. And at the level of meditation, we take that conviction into every aspect of our being. We let it permeate every aspect of our being. And we allow it to transform ourselves on every level. And this is usually in meditation, but it can also arise in life situations as well. And I remember being very struck reading Bhante talking about his own practice of wisdom and saying that most of his wisdom arose through reflecting, not through meditation, because he said he found it quite easy to get concentrated, but you just sit in an armchair and reflect and take his insight, take his wisdom deeper. He also said, interestingly enough, that from a very early age, the age of about 16, he could pick up any Dharma text, no matter what tradition it was, and have immediate understanding of it and be able to teach it. There are lots of little gems like this hidden in the seminar, so you should read them. Okay, so just to finish off, we're going to move back and forth. So sometimes we may reflect and we realise we don't understand something, so we need to go back to the text and study more deeply. Sometimes we're in meditation and we realise we need to do more reflection and so on. So the three levels of wisdom are not just progressive, we can have them going on all the time. And wisdom really is a deepening of the Dharma in our being. And we can keep on deepening our understanding of the Dharma in our being, in our experience, until the transcendental path arises. And after ordination, which is effective going for refuge, that's our next goal. It's real going for refuge, actually having direct experience of reality face to face. And then the three levels of wisdom are starting to manifest in a full-blown sort of way, and we enter the transcendental path, which carries us down to enlightenment. So that's my talk. Mm-hmm. Okay.